Good afternoon. Today is May 7th, 2009. My name is Maxine Ferris. I'm a retired professor in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources and formerly the Director of Outreach Communications. It's my pleasure to visit this afternoon with Dr. Frederick R. Wickert, Professor Emeritus of Psychology and the Graduate School of Business Administration at Michigan State University. Our conversation is part of the Oral History Project of the MSU Emeriti Faculty Association Steering Committee. Well, Fred, I know that you've had a very busy and active professional life. Let's start at the beginning, though. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Chicago and then in California.
Okay. I had a fairly rough time in Chicago because my father got sick and died when I was only 4 years old.
That's terrible.
And so we moved in with my mother's father, who was a cigar maker. He had there were really quite a few cigar factories, and there's some economic studies that show that a cigar maker factory is not efficient with more than 30 employees. So he had his 30 employees for a while. And so we lived with tobacco. Crates came from Sumatra and Cuba and other places.
So perhaps that began your interest in world travel.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
And so where did you go then to school, both high school and college?
Went to high school and semester of high school and at Schurz High School in Chicago, which has at that time was one of the largest high schools in the world. And it was a great place because they had good teachers. Then my mother married a friend from high school who worked in the fruit business in California. So we moved to California. I finished my last three years of high school in Monrovia, California.
And so that, no doubt, encouraged you to go to school in California, to college.
Yeah, so UCLA was pretty cheap at $20 tuition a semester. So, and that was a great place. It was full of people associated with the movie business. And while I was there, we went to I got involved in plays and movies. As a matter of fact, I could have gone into the movie business instead of going on to graduate school. It was, and I knew all kinds of, whenever I went to a movie then, I knew about half the extras because I'd already worked with them.
So you mean you were an extra in movies?
Well, I could have been, but I preferred going on to graduate school.
So what did you major in then as an undergrad?
Psychology. And you asked here why did I get interested in psychology. And I ran across some writing in books that indicated how a few psychologists, had gotten into making industry, especially manufacturing industry, which in the 20s was a predominant kind of industrial activity. So this was, they indicated all kinds of ways that psychology could be useful in management. Psychology was a young science, and nobody really knew much about this, but for example, even in military, it was found that if you had a squad of soldiers digging trenches, which was common in World War I, if they didn't stop and take a rest, they just kept right on working, they could do so many feet of, dig so many feet of trenches so wide and so deep. On the other hand, if they would stop and spend 50 minutes out of the hour resting, in only 10 minutes digging, they could do twice as much trench digging as the ones that kept digging all the time.
Oh, isn't that
this goes against common sense. And so that kind of, there are all kinds of things that beginning industrial psychologists were doing. And I thought, that sounds like a good career.
So was part of this Jungian psychology?
Part of what?
Of Jung, Carl Jung's psychology, or was he a little later than that?
No.
Because he did a lot of things with management style.
Well, he was more a clinical psychologist. And,
so about what time, when were you at, you at in college?
I was in college from 1929 to 1933, graduated in 1933.
So then what happened after you finished your degree there? What does a psychologist with an undergraduate degree do?
Go to graduate school. Well, in the meantime, though, since my dad was in fruit packing, I had a lot of work, and I learned how to do fruit packing, which was paid by the piece and so on. And I found I was applying psychological principles, since I could do piecework faster than about anybody else. it really works. So let's see.
So you did that, and then after that, you obviously decided to either take a job elsewhere or continue your education.
Well, I went on to, there were just four universities that had industrial psychology as a graduate choice: Stanford, Chicago, Pennsylvania, and some other place. I can't remember. But I had an aunt living in Chicago, and so I didn't have much money, and I could stay with her at times. So I went to Chicago. Once I got into graduate work, the professor had all kinds of projects I could do and get paid for, including consumer interviewing. I worked for a while with life insurance agents, getting them to really, it was a selection of life insurance agents. What happens in life insurance is that the relatives of the manager keep trying to get the manager to hire their relatives because it's a job that pays, and if the applicant doesn't have anything else to do, he can always sell insurance. Well, we found that these guys would sell everybody in their family four or five policies, and then they couldn't sell anymore. But we were able, through psychological tests, select the applicants for being an agent in such way that if they got good scores on it, they became good life insurance agents. And the Life Insurance Sales Research Bureau in Connecticut sponsored this research anyway. And so our test for the selection of life insurance agents was then used all over the country. Problem was, as soon as people discovered what the right answers were, the general manager, if he had a pal he wanted to give a job to, he'd tell him what the right answers were. So we had to keep revising this. So the job lasted for a while.
Well, you're doing graduate work at the University of Chicago has certainly been a prestigious kind of thing to have on your resume.
Well, I hope so.
Well, at least this last year, as I understand it, the MBA program ranked number one for the first time in several years.
Yeah.
So that's great.
So, yeah.
Well, after you finished your degree...
Well, my professor's office was in the College of Business and Management, and so I spent a lot of time there and got to know a number of professors there. And
so psychology, historically, though, has been in social science rather than in business,
that's
and you
right,
kind
yeah.
of later bridged the two.
Yeah. And I took an interesting, couple of interesting courses in graduate school. One of them was with Paul Douglas, who got to be mayor of Chicago, a U.S. senator, and so every once in a while in class, he said, "Well, what does the psychologist say about this?" So it was nice getting to know him. And the other one was in anthropology. And this anthropologist eventually got a job at MSU at, in the College of Business, and was the cultural anthropologist in the College of Business. So we knew each other well, too. All these connections help.
Networking.
That's what it is.
Well, I guess, though, that you didn't jump immediately from a doctoral program into being a professor.
No. As a matter of fact, I thought if I was going to be ever going to be a professor, I really ought to have more industrial experience. So I was still just a graduate student, but I'd finished all my courses. And did you ever hear of Western Electric?
Yes.
So I worked at Western Electric for 4 years, and that was a great experience. It was one of the largest factories in the Chicago area. One out of every six people ever had a job in Chicago at that time worked for Western Electric. 49,000 people under one roof. And they really needed a lot of cultural anthropology. So I worked with the Hawthorne experiment.
Would that have been in the human resources division, or what did they call it then, personnel? Or?
Yeah, personnel, pretty much. Human resources, as a term, came along later.
So you did mostly testing there? Is that what your role was?
No, we had other people do the testing. There were two men, Putnam and Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, who had been in charge of the Hawthorne experiments. And when the time came, they made Wright in charge of the interviewing program.
Maybe we ought to back up. What were the Hawthorne experiments?
Well, the Hawthorne experiments were a way of working to see how to have happy employees, really.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
And what they did was they first had an interviewing program when Western Electric had just 30,000 employees before World War, or before the Depression. And at that time, they interviewed these, had trained interviewers interviewing the employees one by one to get some idea of what they thought about the company and all kinds of things like that. This then was written up in book form, and let's see how to make sense of this. The Depression came along, and the company went down to just 5,000 employees, and they didn't really need them. Then, by 1936, things began to perk along again. And they gave Wright the job of reestablishing the interviewing program to see, because things had happened and the world had changed mm-hmm. after the Depression. Putnam was allowed to have one department and one interviewer. And of something like 200 people applied for this job. And through my professor, I got the job.
Wonderful.
And
so after Western Electric, then, did you continue?
Well,
there?
Even there, one of the things I got put in the training department of the human resources part. I taught motion and time study to foremen so they could get their employees to be more efficient and be more open to the suggestions of the time and motion study engineers, who they hated because the time and motion study engineers set rates that people got paid by. And you can imagine this was not a happy situation.
I never was a time and motion engineer, but for a time I made my living doing time management workshops around the country. I bet you didn't know that.
No.
Well.
So, and then we ran through other classes with foremen. Problem there was, to some extent, the cigarette smoke. Everybody in those days smoked. I never did. And when I'd get out of a two-hour session, I'd just be reeking a cigarette smoke. That's a wonder I didn't get my lungs wrecked, but no problem.
So then how long in total were you at Western Electric?
About 4 years. Then the Supreme Court, in its supreme wisdom, came along and said that AT&T was a monopoly and had to be broken up. Western Electric was the manufacturing part of AT&T, so it was, the threat was to break it up. In the meantime, the Light and Power Company in Chicago, Commonwealth Edison, thought they needed a psychologist, so they hired me, and I went to work for them for a while, about a year or two. Then the war came along, and as a reserve officer from ROTC, I and about 25 other psychologists who had gone through ROTC, we all got together in Washington, and they made us replacement training officers for replacement training centers. And let me explain just the military
Please.
Situation briefly. A draftee was sent for a week to get his uniform and get oriented to being a soldier. And then was sent for 9 weeks at a replacement training center where the soldier learned the skill that he was going to use in the military. And after that 9 weeks, he was sent to the unit to which he was going to be, in which he was going to be working. And in that unit, he learned to perform as a member of a team using the skills that he had learned in the replacement training center. That's the way the military was set up. Very logical.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent, first I was going to go to Signal Corps, but they didn't really have enough of us. And they said, the Signal Corps has bright people in it. They don't need you so much. But the Coast Artillery, they're pretty dumb. They're going to need you. They turned out to be right. Unfortunately, a lot of those guys had been around these big guns and lost their hearing.
Right.
It was a pretty rough business. Well, anyway, at that camp, the colonel, he should have been a general in charge, and the S1 who was in charge of personnel and the man in charge of training and me, were the four of us really ran the camp. We'd get a batch of 6,000 soldiers in, 6,000 draftees, and my job was to interview these 6,000, take advantage of their previous skills and their interests, and assign them to training, to skill training. And then, of course, the training officer was in charge of the various kinds of training. So I had about 150, well, a few officers and mostly enlisted men who did the interviewing. And they then worked out what specialty they were going to get go into. So I had a big job there. And as a first lieutenant, everybody else being colonels and so on, pretty interesting.
As a lowly doctoral candidate, I bet you never expected
to get a job like that, yeah.
So you were probably like the colonel, really.
That's really what it was. At that time, I was in the sanitary corps. Why the sanitary corps? Because the medical corps was divided into four branches from World War I. Doctors, MDs, and second, dentists, and third, administrators who did the paperwork for the doctors, and fourth, everybody else, and we were all put in the sanitary corps. And as a psychologist, I got put in the sanitary corps.
Well, given your varied experience after you completed your studies, you probably felt that you really did have a good handle on what the real world was like before you entered academia.
Oh, yeah.
So then let's talk a little bit about your first coming to Michigan State and why Michigan State.
Okay, well, when the war was over, I went back to the Commonwealth Edison, the public utility. And it wasn't long before a psychologist friend of mine said, who was a professor at the University of Illinois, said one of our University of Illinois professors is going to be assigned to Michigan State to be chair of this new psychology department. And they need psychologists like crazy. So he interviewed me, and I came to MSU, and remember Harry Kimber at all?
No, I guess that was before my time.
He was in charge of religion, of all things, but he was in sort of just below a dean, but above a chair of a department. And he and the chair of the department interviewed me and hired me. And we had about seven or eight industrial psychology professors. And pretty soon, as your notes here say, what happened when MSU woke up and started finding that they could start economizing on professors. So instead of each of us teaching a section of beginning industrial psychology, pretty soon it was just one large lecture section, and we all began teaching more advanced courses in IO psychology.
Well, so you had about a half a dozen professors at that time. Then what kind of a student enrollment would you have had? I mean, was this a popular major, do you think? Or
yeah, it was reasonably popular.
And did you, from the beginning, have graduate students as well as undergrads?
Not at the beginning, but we began to start getting graduate students. And first we were just going to give master's degrees, but the department as a whole decided a master's degree was in psychology, it turned out, wasn't really worth too much. And
where were you housed at that time? Do you remember? I bet you've been in a number of buildings on campus.
Yeah, in the one of these.
You never were in a Quonset hut, were you?
Oh yeah.
Were you?
Yeah, we were in a Quonset hut.
Then we finally
bought a house in East Lansing. There were just two houses available in all of East.
Oh, so you were married, and then you and the family moved into a Quonset.
Yeah.
A lot of people have very fond memories of those days of sharing with one another.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. And glad to get a house finally, though.
Well, when did you get involved with international activities, and when did you kind of make the link between social science and management?
Uh, You asked two questions.
I'm known for that.
Well, with respect to, I was just teaching psychology in psychology classes, and beginning, we got together and started the graduate program as well.
And so that's when you start doing research on campus,
yeah,
as well as teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Fulbright's came along, and I had been at MSU for 6 years, and I was due for a seventh year. So I applied for a Fulbright in France and got it.
Did you speak French at that time?
Yeah, I'd had some years of French. Do you remember John Useem?
Yes, I do.
John and I took 2 years of French at UCLA and sat next to each other. So we knew each other well before. It's a big surprise to find each other here.
Well, in those days, most doctoral students had a choice of, well, you were expected to speak at least, or to have proficiency in two foreign languages.
Yeah, I had to do both German and French.
But by the time I came along, we wound up being able to do one foreign language and do a language substitute.
Oh, yeah.
I had
to do two languages at the University of Chicago.
Okay, then that's how you became such a linguist.
Well, I had French, yeah. And then 7 years later, an opportunity came along in Austria, and so I had German too. And so I taught in German then in Austria after having taught a year in France.
So what kind of work were you affiliated with a university in those places?
Yeah, I was a professor teaching classes. I'm trying to think of the experiences. In France, the professor knew about organizational behavior, industrial psychology, and he had picked out a young man from his department, and he was in the States learning industrial psychology, but he needed somebody to get the program started in France. And so it was at the University of Toulouse, and he was a member of the Chamber of Deputies in Paris, so he was away a good deal of the time. But so I was pretty much on my own, and I had a bunch of great students.
I expect you had a chance to do some travel on the side.
Yeah, every chance we got, whenever there was a vacation, off we went someplace else. Saw the tulips in bloom in Holland, did Norway, Sweden, and Denmark on another trip, another vacation. Then when I got to Austria, same thing happened. Whenever we got a vacation, we took off for some place. For example, we spent some time in Spain. We went to Spain for Easter-type holidays.
You know, I think that that's one of the real benefits of being a faculty family, because you at times may feel that your salary is not equivalent to what it would be in business or the professions, but on the other hand, the
you get opportunities that nobody else
can equal that.
And then we got to Italy and got all over Italy for a while.
So. And so you had several children at that time.
Yeah.
Well, that was a great experience for them, too.
Well, I didn't always think so.
So did it seem boring coming back to the campus here after these...
After all that excitement?
Yes.
No, there was a lot of catching up to do. Things had changed somewhat.
Okay. In what ways? Well, we had John Hanna by then, certainly.
Yeah. That was true. Do you want me to look at the John Hanna contact?
Yeah, let's talk about you and John Hanna.
Okay.
I suspect that you were a pretty valuable asset for him.
Well, I guess so. maybe I should mention something how I got into management too, because it wasn't until I came in 1947. It wasn't until 1960, Dean Seeley of the management school, said he was needing professors badly. He said, I'll give a joint appointment to anybody else who seems qualified to teach. So I went, interviewed him, and he said, yeah, we need you in management department. So he worked a board appointment. So I had a board appointment in management and, of course, in psychology, too. So it was a real workout to go to two department meetings.
And committees.
And committees, yeah, it was really something else. But this then led to getting us a John Hanna professor in organizational psychology. And so we had a number of them through the years. So they were, the last one became a John Hanna professor. So that was, I guess I got something started then.
I guess maybe you were kind of an agitator.
I guess so. Well, John Hanna then called me another time and said, we've got a visitor from Iran. He's a senator in Iran. This was under the Shah. Mm-hmm. And he wants to see the campus, but he wants somebody who can speak French, but he doesn't want anybody from the French department. He's had his fill of them. So you're the only one I could find who could do French. So I took this senator around for a while. Then another time he called me and said, they need you in Washington right away for Peace Corps. They're just getting Peace Corps started. So I went to Washington and spent 6 months in Peace Corps getting Peace Corps started. And that was there. You know Bill Moyers?
Yes.
As a program. He came in shortly after I did. And I was in selection. That is the way the Peace Corps worked. When an applicant's papers came in, selection would decide whether or not the individual would be a good Peace Corps volunteer. And then we had another group called recruiting, and Bill Moyers got to be in charge of recruiting. And recruiting amounted to the advertising of getting Peace Corps people to volunteer for the Peace Corps, and it was their job to do the advertising and selling a Peace Corps. Then when we got those people, we'd work out which country they would go to and what kind of specialty they would have. And then they were sent for training in their specialty for several months. And then they would go out on assignment as a Peace Corps volunteer.
Well, that was a nice kind of interruption to your work. And I think maybe one of the reasons maybe you were always so productive is that you didn't just work constantly doing the same old, same old.
Oh, no.
And
right.
With,
yeah.
Not only with the two Fulbrights, which in themselves is remarkable that you had two of them.
Well, actually, I had more than that. Once the State Department people discovered me for the next few years, I got sent to Africa. It was always Africa, different countries, to do training of managers, since my record already showed I had done that at Western Electric. And we did some of that, of course. We did some outplacement work from the department. We started getting contacts elsewhere, in Michigan companies especially. We had one man Carl Frost. Ever run into him?
Oh, yes. I knew him quite well, as well as his wife, Evelyn.
Yeah. Well, he got industries in Western Michigan all excited about the Scanlon plan. And so we often worked with him. Well, anyway.
Well, when I look at your resume, Fred, and see the number of countries in which you had international activities, it really sort of blows your mind. France, Japan, Korea, Austria, Australia, New Zealand, Chad, Upper Volta, Mali, and the Ivory Coast. I mean, that is remarkable.
And Vietnam. I went with the Vietnam project from MSU for 2 years.
And talk a little bit about that and how your family got involved in that, in the Vietnam project.
Yeah. Most of the people in the Vietnam Project were from political science, since Wes Fischel was a political scientist, and they tried to get everybody from political science if they could. However, one of the four main jobs in Vietnam was in-service training. The French didn't especially want to train Vietnamese to do anything. They wanted to do it all themselves. But they did have a few, and when they did have a Vietnamese, he had to have a supervisor who was a Frenchman, and any subordinates had to be French. It was a funny kind of...
Well, I believe you told me your wife was employed there also.
Oh, yeah. The ambassador called her one day and said, I want you to come and see me. And he said, we're going to start an American school. This was the time when most of the Americans who worked there had families with children, and they needed an American school. And as a matter of fact, people from other countries, from embassies and so on, also needed some kind of probably English-speaking school. So he made her superintendent, principal, and teacher all at the same time, and then she got other people to be teachers, but she was the only one who had a teacher's certificate. So she was the only one who was real teaching experience.
Well, I'm sure that she looked back on that as a very positive part of her career life as well.
Oh, yeah, she thought that was wonderful. And she took it as a matter of course. And it was really good in a sense because she was on leave from the Lansing City Schools. And when they give you a leave, even without pay, they want you to make a positive experience out of that. So that helped.
Well, that was good because both of the two overseas experiences we had, I was promised that I would have some kind of significant kind of employment or tasks to do, even as a volunteer, and that never happened in either case. And I always felt that that was I was shortchanged as a professional in another country. And I would have liked and appreciated having had that kind of experience.
Well, when I went to New Zealand and Australia later on, this was just a year's leave without a Fulbright, but I had good connections in both New Zealand and Australia. New Zealand, I was an Erskine professor. A wealthy New Zealander realized that New Zealand was so isolated that it needed continual contact with the rest of the world. And so when they found out I was really new, had connections in Australia but not New Zealand very well, so they were glad to get me in New Zealand so I could teach courses there. And they had a young man there who was had a master's in organizational psychology, and I got him, introduced him to management people all over New Zealand and got him started. Otherwise, they wouldn't have accepted him very well. This happens quite a lot. We had another graduate student who got to that point, but it's connected, who was from Zambia in Africa. And they didn't really respect him very much. He had his PhD from us and was teaching classes at the University of Zambia in the capital city, Lusaka. And I had him come. I had myself have another one of these Fulbright mm-hmm. things and arrangements. And I put on some training sessions with the people who ran the copper mines in Zambia. Zambia has a lot of big, something like 15 copper mines. And each copper mine had a human resources department. So I had the the chief of human resources in each copper mine come, and I spent a week with them, bringing them up to date on what they should, what they could be doing with their work. And they were all under the guidance of a professor from Swansea University in Wales. And so he and I worked together and helped train these guys to do human resources in the copper mines better. And did a lot of work with some of the professors in the school. Anyway, because I had this former graduate student of ours, his PhD, helped me do some things, he got well known.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And eventually became Secretary of Labor in the government.
When I hear you discuss some of these experiences, I can see layers. Your strong networking with fellow students and colleagues around, yeah. really around the world.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, these graduate students that you linked with through various projects, which gave you really a worldwide network of, in a sense, yeah, influence.
That's right. You get connections that way.
Well, as you think about it, Fred, how has your discipline changed through the years?
Well, quite a lot. At first, industrial psychologists is what they were called, tended to, not necessarily, some of us taught in universities, but others of us had jobs at Western Electric or Commonwealth Edison, working for a company. But companies eventually did not really want to hire people who were permanently on their payroll. And so consulting companies of industrial psychologists were formed. And when companies needed industrial psychological services, they would hire people from a consulting company. And so nowadays, most industrial psychologists work in consulting companies and go out then to other companies as a consultant. And the more they can keep getting clients for the consulting company, the better off they are too. So that's really the shape of things now. It's all consulting company, and the IO psychologists then working with companies to get them to hire consultants.
Okay. Another question related to that might be, how does your work itself, I guess what I'm driving at, or what kind of test instruments or tools, or what is the role of interviewing versus using some kind of testing? I guess you, in a broad sense, those would be the technologies of your discipline.
Well, the way human resources works, first in first need to recruit employees to work for your organization. Once you've recruited them, you've got to select the ones who are worth working for your company. So that involves testing and interviewing. And then after they're selected, they need to be trained. And so I've often worked in training departments. And after they're trained, then they get a regular job and they can be promoted, or they have to be kept happy and contented with their work and keep developing as employees. And so there are these this sort of sequence of recruiting, selection, training, and keeping them happy.
When I came back to
the same thing was true in Peace Corps.
When I came back to the university full time, half of my job was in staff development for the what was then called the Cooperative Extension Service, now MSU Extension. And so I had a nice network nationally of, from other land-grant schools, too. But we always felt like we were underfunded. Is that a pattern that historically the industrial psychologists or the people from your experience always have felt kind of like they had to beg, borrow, and steal or write grants?
There was some of that. But some of the jobs, for example, AT&T for a while had quite a big group of us. And they were so established that they probably got adequate recompense. But so it varied quite a bit.
Well, given your understanding of human beings and how we operate, what would be your observation relative to campus politics? Do we have more of it, less of it?
Is
it different?
Know.
Did you always steer clear of it, if you were smart?
Yeah, I didn't really have a lot to do with it. Of course, I had to do work with the political scientists. One of the things we did, for example, was we got a grant from Carnegie to assess the impact that American universities were making around the world.
Wow, what a challenge.
Yeah, and do you remember Ed Widener at all? He was chair of political science.
I can't say, I knew a number of people in there.
Well, he was the chief of the Institute for Research on Overseas Programs, it was called, IROP. And since we knew each had known each other in Vietnam, Adams and Garrity, do you remember Walt Adams?
Oh, very right? Well, yes.
Okay, Walt Adams and Garrity got France. Another guy got Indonesia because he knew it. I got the Near East and all of Africa. And what I did was to find American university programs in those areas, went to the universities that had the programs, interviewed them, found, for example, that Harvard had more programs than any other university in the U.S., and didn't know it. They don't need to count stuff like that. MSU, as a political thing, needs to count and show off how wonderful they are. Harvard doesn't bother. It's already wonderful.
I suspect that your passport is, or I should say passports, are really collector's items.
They are. They have some wonderful stamps from French colonies and so on. So,
Fred, I'm not sure, when did you retire? Or do we want to talk about that?
Well, I don't remember.
Well, as you look back, though, over all
I was 70 anyway.
You were 70.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, as you look back over your years as part of the MSU community in its broadest sense. What kinds of observations would you like to share with future generations about the changes that have taken place or the things that have been really positive, things you'd like to see improve in the future?
Well, I had some other, let me give you some other connections that will lead to that.
All right, that's good.
When Kimber and Milder wanted MSU to get a chapter of Phi Beta Kappa. So for years, they went to the general meetings of the national meetings of Phi Beta Kappa. And Phi Beta Kappa kept telling them, we really don't like to have big universities like MSU. We have a few already, like University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But we just as soon not have them because the professors don't know the individual students well enough.
Ouch.
And we want professors to know individual students well. Well, finally, Phi Beta Kappa said, we'll try you. And so Kimber and Milder got the chapter for here. Then they got a hold of me and said, you're Phi Beta Kappa from UCLA, and what we want you to do, we've done our part in getting a chapter here. We want you to keep the chapter going. So I had to get a reasonably distinguished professor to be president of Phi Beta Kappa for a year. That's twisting arms. And that's how I got to know some MSU politics. And finally, it ended up so that the Honors College has pretty well taken over Phi Beta Kappa. But in the meantime, for 10 years, I had to scout around and get politically able enough professors to take the presidency of Phi Beta Kappa. And then after I retired, I got active in the Senior Center. And in the Senior Center,
You're speaking of the center in East Lansing that was formerly a middle school.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was down in
that building behind People's Church at one time?
Yeah, that used to be the American Legion Hall.
All right.
And so I worked with them.
And I know that you've also been involved
in
that.
And that led to also working with the MSU Retirees Association.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so MSU Retirees Association was really sort of just getting started. And I served as a kind of liaison between the senior center that's in the Hanna School now.
Yes.
And the Retirees Association, because they had a lot of news in common, a lot of developments in common. Well, the Retirees Association people thought I was active enough that they made me president of Retirees Association. So I had a year doing that. And that gets you into all kinds of politics with respect to the staff versus faculty.
Oh, yes.
And that's a continuing problem. Now, for example, the Emeriti have all the connections and the staff feels left out. It's a difficult situation.
Well, I think some of us who were involved with service units perhaps feel more akin to both groups than somebody who is strictly...
Uh-huh.
In an academic line of progression, or was
Well, I was glad to get the exposure to the staff people, too. So that helped a lot.
Well, and you also, I know, for a number of years were very heavily involved in the lecture and lunch series that still runs at the University Club, and you were good.
Yeah, I'm still active with that.
In planning that.
And, yeah, what we used to do is have each one of us would take a month of getting speakers, and it would come around once a year, this assignment for getting speakers. Now we're delighted that we've got one man who was editor of the MSU Alumni Magazine. He's got all kinds of journalistic connections, and he gets speakers now. We don't do it anymore.
Well, Fred, I think as I look at the life that you have lived, both in academia and in the community, it's certainly been a life of contribution, and no doubt there have been a great many satisfactions. Could you identify just a couple of things that have been most satisfying for you?
Oh, let's see.
I don't mean to throw you a curve here, but...
No. It was fun getting away and doing all these overseas things. The problem is that, with respect to politics, that the department doesn't know that they've got you, and so raises are difficult to get. In spite of the fact that MSU was proud of its international programs, at first MSU was not. They thought international programs were a drag on the rest of the university, and the university shouldn't have anything to do with them. Thank goodness for Hannah, and he finally got a message across to departments. But a lot of departments still feel the same way, that their staff should just stay right on campus and not do anything else.
Well, Fred, this hour has gone rather quickly talking with you. I don't know if there are any other comments that you would like to make in closing.
Well, I've written four books, sometimes about international things, and over 100 articles, so that adds up to something.
Well, it certainly is.
I still stayed active as far as the department was concerned, because they respect publications, and that's one way of getting noticed. Let's see if there's anything else. Oh, yeah. One year, through connections with a psychologist in South Africa, of all places, he's an industrial psychologist, too, and we knew each other from meetings. The International Biological Year. Remember when they used to have international years, and this was the year of biology? And psychology, to some extent, is a biological science. You can see biological
yes.
aspects of it. So he got people from Singapore, Japan, France, and so on. And we all met in London. And I got my expenses paid through NATO, of all things. So I was the only U.S. representative of psychology in the international year for biology. So that was kind of a... We stayed in the street that all the doctors have their offices on in London. And we all got invited to become members of the British Medical Society. I never did do it, but so that was a kind of unexpected thing. And again, sort of international. Let's see, anything else?
Well, Fred, that I can certainly say that yours has been a life well lived.
It's been fun.
And it's been fun, and I think that's what keeps you so young and active and so with it, and such an enjoyable companion to chat with this afternoon as part of the Oral History Project of the Emeriti Faculty Steering Committee. Thank you so much for sharing with us, and have a good evening.
And thanks for being such a good interviewer.
You're welcome.